of all, a housekeeping note. As many of you might know by now from the email from earlier in the week, I will not be here next week. Kemirat Hashem, as of Wednesday night, I should be sleeping in Sderot. So you could daven for me.
Okay.
But I will hopefully be there in the yeshiva. And Thursday is very exciting, as the Chanukah Sabbath of the new yeshiva there. That in the dorm, the dorms in the yeshiva are bracket proof. Hashem Yerachem. But they have to do it. They have to do it. So I look forward to being there and hopefully having a meaningful and productive trip. But we will not be learning, obviously, next week. What I hope to do this week, however, is to finish up the story that we've been working on the last 3 weeks, which is the story of the shame of Noach. And we saw the events themselves culminate last week. We saw the various opinions in Chazal and Mefarshim, what exactly happened to Noach. Was he merely embarrassed, the kind of thing that we all might feel if one of our kids walked in on us in the bathroom or the shower or something like that? That's the most innocent small shame he might have felt. And of course, there were the opinions quoted in the Gemara that are much, much more degrading and demeaning to Noach. We saw some of the subsequent psukim as well in previous weeks, but I want to pick up with that theme and those psukim and finish the parak Mirz Hashem tonight. In subsequent weeks, there are, you know, the end of Noach has the list of all of the families and the names, and I'm not sure yet if or how much there will be to say in the shir on that. We may end up skipping that. But, of course, there is still at least one more significant story in Parshas Noach, and that, of course, is the Migdal Babel or the Dor HaFloga, and that is certainly a very fascinating story, which I have long wanted to study. With the depth that Emirat Hashem we will study. So look forward to that in the coming weeks. Okay, we left off in terms of our real iyun of it, of the psukim, kind of in the middle of Chav Gimel. We did a little bit of Chav Gimel, but perhaps not sufficiently. So to review, we saw last week the various stages of Noach getting drunk, falling asleep in his tent, him being covered, and then somebody, either Cham or Canaan, we saw that debate last week, coming in and seeing what he did, seeing him, and perhaps doing more than just seeing him, as well as the Pasuk tells us that he was V'yaged L'shneachav, that the other brothers were told, and we noted that V'yaged is not just V'yomer, V'yaged is both in detail and perhaps with enthusiasm, and that was very severe. So then, we started seeing last week, and we'll pick up with again this week, Pasuk Chav Gimel. So that's where the tide turns, and at least you have a slightly better ending to the story, and then you have the actual culmination with Noach's realization and then his pronouncements towards his children. So let's take it again from there. Chav Gimel. V'yikach Shem V'yefes. Again, we're Perek Tes Pasuk Chav Gimel. V'yikach Shem V'yefes Es Hasimla. They took the garment, yasimu al shechem shnehem, they put it on their shoulders, vayelchu acharonis, and they walked in backwards, v'yichasu eis erbas avihem, and they covered their father's nakedness, v'nehem acharonis, erbas avihem lo ra'u. Even as they covered him, they still had their back towards him so that they would not see him in a compromised position. So here, of course, you have the obvious and dramatic contrast between their behavior and either Cham or Canaan's previous behavior. Not only were they doing their action to preserve his dignity, as opposed to the previous action, which was to humiliate him, but even as they were doing it to preserve his dignity, they did it in a way in which they didn't even see what might have been legitimate to see, given the circumstances. You know, you might have said this is the kind of thing, you know, whether you see your parent undressed or not, that really depends on context and intent. And here, where their only intent was to help him, what could have been so bad? And the answer is that's probably true. And nevertheless, they still, even within the context of doing the right thing for the right reasons, they still went out of their way to make sure not to look. And it's a very important musr for all of us all to keep. I have actually had this. I had this once as a shayla, halacha l'maisa, from a member of our shul who had an elderly parent who needed to be bathed. Sorry? Hachu. Please and me too. So Hachu is more confusing. Not for you. Okay, anyways, I had this as a real shiloh about bathing, and it's an issue even if it's a daughter to a mother or a son to a father, and it's certainly an issue of female to male and male to female. And the basic psak, even with the same sex, is it's really better not to. It's really better to get an aide or some other relative. If it's really absolutely, absolutely necessary, so then it would be permissible. But it really is better not to. And it really draws its inspiration, the poskim to speak about it, from this story. Because again, here you're bathing your parent, obviously again doing it, for the right reason, etc. And nevertheless, there's an issue of shame that would be involved to the parent, which obviously these sons were sensitive to. So we started noting last week, and we only outside touched on the Chazal and the Rashi, but I want to get back to it today, and that is a very famous Midrash. But before we see the Midrash, and the Midrash is going to be Drush personified, in the sense that the actual conclusions of the Midrash are really off the text. But as we have pointed out over the years in this year, when we're sensitive to it, really, really good Drush starts with pshat. Really good drush is a response to something in the text, which is really a pshat issue, and then the way it's resolved may be through the method of drush. But it's not completely far-fetched and unnecessary. It's not gratuitous. The better the medrash, the more it's grounded in a pshat sensitivity. So if you take a look at this pasuk, there seems to be an inconsistency in some of the descriptive words. You have vayikach, and then you have vayasimu, and vayelchu, and vayichasu, and ra'u. So, as they would say in Sesame Street, one of these is not like the other. Which one is different? Of course, the first one, vayikach, is in Lashon Yachid. So, why should that be? After all the others are in plural, and for obvious reason, because the pasuk itself tells us it's two sons, not one. So take a look at the source on your first source on your sheet is a medrash, a primary source, which becomes the inspiration for Rashi. Vayikach shem v'yefes esas simla, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, shem hitchil b'mitzvah chila, shem actually went first, uba yefes v'nishmalo. And Yefes kind of, followed him, as they would say in the Israeli army, Acharai, follow me. Lefichach ozocha shame letalis, shame got a better reward, shame gets a spiritual reward. The mitzvah of talis is connected to shame and his descendants, which of course are the Jewish people, and it's a discuss. The Yefes lepayavla, I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce it, but it's some kind of mechubud garment, and I'm not sure exactly which historical context, perhaps Roman, I'm not sure exactly what the historical context is, but it's some kind of mechubud, like a garment. Unless he was rewarded, but in a way that is clearly intended to be secondary, it's more material than spiritual, and again, the explanation being because shame took the initiative. So let's take a look, how does Rashi quote this medrash? Rashi says, Pasuk of Gimel, v'yikach shem v'yefes. Ein ksiv v'yikchu. It does not say v'yikchu in the plural. Ela v'yikach. So again, even though where we're headed is very much a bedrush, but we start off with a very important and a very cogent shot notion and sensitivity. Limed al shem, said the medrash, says Rashi, it's coming to teach us about shame. Shenit ametz the mitzvah. He was more exertive in his fulfillment of the mitzvah, Yosir Miyefes, even more than his brother, Lakach Zochu Banav, therefore his children and descendants were Zochu, were privileged, Latalus Shel Tzitzis, they had a spiritual mitzvah as a reward. The Yefes, who still did a good thing, Zocha Likvura Levanav, he merited some kind of a special burial from his children. In other words, as the Mefarshim point out, that those that are descended from Yefes have a special level of burial, even in the land of Eretz Yisrael, and this is somehow a reference to the Battle of Gog and Magog. It's a little bit off the beaten track. Why this is very different than the conclusion of the Medrash that I quoted is because I think that there's also a Medrash Tanchuma that Rashi is using. There's two basic midrashim which make this point, and for whatever reason, Rashi here seems to be going in the conclusion with the Tanchuma, as opposed to the one that I quoted to you, the Medrash Rabbah, a slightly different reward. But either way, the truth of the matter is that before we see two commentaries on this Medrash, just off the top of your head, so what is the cause and effect? What's they always tell you, and whether it's as a teacher or especially as a parent, you know, good punishments or good rewards are minyan l'inyan, are very much connected. They don't seem to be arbitrary. So why are these the rewards? What makes the most obvious sense? What's the obvious connection?
Well, it's just because they covered.
The reward, the effort, the mitzvah itself took place with the clothing. So the reward was clothing. So if you ask me, if that's the simple theme, which it clearly to me is, so the Medrash Rabbah makes more sense than the Tanchuma, because here, even in the Medrash Rabbah, both Shem and Yefes get rewards of clothing. Just one has a spiritual and a religious dimension, and the other does not.
Well,
burial
is clothing. Burial is a cover.
Right. So I was going to say, you took the words out of my mouth. I was going to say that perhaps that's also why the Medrash Tanchuma, even though it's more far afield, but it still can be connected back to the theme of preserving the dignity of the parent. You know, there's two other ways that bodies were disposed of, certainly historically. One was there was cremation, which was not a new thing. It was never a Jewish thing, but it's certainly not an old thing. And then there were those that were just left out. You know, there's a certain effort it takes to doing a burial. Not every society in history felt that was so necessary. Certainly not before they realized that there were diseases and other things that could be caught. So this is the most dignified way of removing the body, and perhaps that is connected as well. Gene, one more thing before I take your question or your comment, and that is, it's something that I didn't have time to put on the sheet, but it's worth noting, is that I saw. One second, am I thinking of the right thing? I saw from the Oznaim LaTorah, that's Rav Sirotskin, who was the Rav of Lutsk, and then he had a son who became Rosh Hashiva in Telz, if you know the Sirotskins from Cleveland eventually. Anyway, so the Oznaim LaTorah, we've quoted him over the years in the Shir, it's a very nice parish in Chumash, so he suggests something slightly different, especially with the language of Rashi of Shenit Ametz, that the focus of Rashi, he says, or the focus of the reward, especially for shame, wasn't the action itself, but the bren, the enthusiasm with which it was done. And that's really the mita keneged mita when it comes to tzitzis. Why? Because as we know, and as every high school boy figures out at some point, or sometimes they start in 7th or 8th grade, you don't really have to wear tzitzis. Right? Because if you're not wearing a four-corner garment, then there's no obligation to wear tzitzis, and you can look high and you can look low, and you'll find certainly nowhere in the Chumash and really nowhere in the Gemara that you have to wear a four-corner garment. So why do you have to really wear it? So why is it such a universal thing? Because the Gemara in Menachos says that you're supposed to be running after mitzvos, and this is the example that personifies this. Even though we don't have to be wearing it, we run after, we look for the opportunity to do it. The Gemara also adds something in terms of cosmic justice, that when everything is kind of calm, then if you weren't wearing tzitzis, you wouldn't get punished, meaning if you weren't wearing four corners either. But be'ida and richta, when Hashem is upset anyway, either at the world or at you, so then, once he's upset, then he might throw in the kitchen sink, and this would be that proverbial kitchen sink. You wouldn't want to be caught without your tzitzis at that point. But leave that aside. The answer is, enchanami, it's an expression not of absolute obligation. That's exactly the point. It's an expression of nitametz, of being ambitious, of exerting oneself even more than one has to for a mitzvah.
Correct.
And therefore, that's his. That's what he says, perhaps, is the connection. Yes, Gene.
Parish that speaks about Vayikach being that they were both of one mind, in other words, because there's nothing in here that
I didn't see it, but I would agree with you that from a pshat perspective it's very plausible. It's a very, very plausible. And just the reason that most Mefarshim, at least the ones that I saw, did not, is because what you're pointing at is not just different, it's Pumfakert from the Medrash.
Right.
It's the opposite of the Medrash.
Because
the Medrash goes out of its way to give more credit to Shane. So once you have the Medrash on the book, so that's kind of going to, you know, that's like, you know, getting off the exit. So you're already dealing with... But I'm agreeing with you. Before the Medrash, if I was just looking at the Psukim, I think that's a very plausible reading.
They both walked backwards.
Yeah. 100%. I think... I didn't see, but I wouldn't be shocked if someone said it. Because without the Medrash, it's certainly, in my opinion, plausible. Yes?
It's kind of a technicality. But what mitzvah is the Medrash referring to here?
Probably keep it up of aim.
We're talking about the time of Noah. Keep it up of aim. This is well before Martin.
Very good. And they're also not Jewish.
Right. Well, whatever, yeah.
Right. So that's a good question. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about this.
Rav Moshe
Feinstein has a tshuva about this, and there's a discussion. Some say that that there may be reasons to assume. After all, let me put it this way: before I answer you, there's a second medrash which is more famous about Dama ben Nesina. Right, the most famous medrash in all of the Chazal about Kibbut Av Aim, which every day school kid learns at some point, is about a non-Jew, right, who didn't want to wake up his father even because the jewel was underneath. It's a non-Jew. So we learn, the Gemara condition learns Kibbut Av Aim from the non-Jew. So Moshe was asked about this. How could it be? So he discusses it, and at least the conclusion that Moshe reaches is that while the formal obligation of Kibbut Av Aim as such doesn't apply to non-Jews, but the basic midah of Hakaras HaTov applies to non-Jews. And therefore, it is exemplified through the way one treats one's parents, which even for Jews... according to most Mepharshim, not all, but according to most Mepharshim, is based on a notion of reciprocity and appreciation and Hakar Satov.
And this was a very precise, a precise statement, a precise term.
Yeah, mitzvah. But the mitzvah could be...
In effect, a commandment of Hashem. This is really...
Right, but exactly. Ramosha says they're obligated. Ramosha says, and Hanami, they're obligated. They are obligated. Oh, so you're asking a more general question, which is how could it be? So there, we've discussed this in the past, Harry, and I've certainly discussed this in my halacha shurim. There are a lot of makoros, Rishonim, and well before even this Rav Moshe, and there's others, the Netziv, Rav Kook, and other who are more recent, obviously contemporaries of Rav Moshe, who speak about the notion that Shem Mitzvah B'nai Noach is only really referring to things which are not necessarily ritual, but not, more of a limited canon, but that it was never meant to be exclusive, but that basic mitzvos of menschlichkeit or rational mitzvos, sichlios, or midos, may be obligatory on all human beings. There's a lot of mefarshim. I'm not saying everyone holds like that, but there's a lot of mefarshim, going back even to some Rishonim, who make that point. Or Moshe has a different tshuva about davening, right, where Moshe was asked about prayer in public schools. He wasn't commenting politically, but he was. They were asking him whether I think I don't remember, but it's possible that the Aguda asked him, because I guess the question was, should we leave aside other considerations, but are we obligated to fight it, given the fact that there are Jews in the classroom? So he said that as long as it's a non-denominational prayer, which it is, he actually thought it wasn't a problem. And he said, in that context, that tshuva, he mentions that non-Jews don't have the obligation to pray on a daily basis the way we may, but he says, be'es tzara, so if there's a catastrophe, there's some kind of a tragedy or some fear of something, he says, non-Jews are also obligated to pray. He says, where did they get it from? So he says very ingeniously, no atheists in a foxhole. Moshe paskins that. I don't know if he quotes it. I don't recall. I doubt it. But he paskins that. He says, it's a truth. It's a truism. And therefore, he says, someone who doesn't pray, then just means that the takar, you know, that's a chisaron in belief. And non-Jews have to believe in God. And therefore, as an expression of their belief in God, they would have to pray in those type of extreme situations, which is a very fascinating, I think, insightful tshuva. But we've gotten far afield. Let's go back to the source sheet. Let's take a look at the Hamek Dover. So one possibility is it was just a question of Mita, can I get Mita clothing versus clothing? I mentioned to you from the Zlaim LaTorah that maybe Shame had this issue of enthusiasm and ambition. Comes the Hamek Dover with a beautiful pshat of his own. He quotes the Rashi, which we've just seen, and then he says, where did it come from? You know, you'll ask the question, especially in light of Gene's assumption, Taka, why should it have been? Why should Shame? We know that they're both good guys. So why was it that Shame was more into it than Yefes? So he says, very fascinating, Lo Mishum, and just as a word of note, for those of you who may be less familiar with the Netziv, one of the meta characteristics of his parish is he's very psychologically attuned. So here he says, Lo mishum shehergeshu shel shame hayechazak yoter. It's not pshat which is what we would have thought, that he somehow cared more, that his feelings of righteousness and or indignity or covet for his father, it wasn't that he felt that anymore. Ela mishum the shame, hergishu, mishum mitzvah. Shame understood that there was something religiously, spiritually problematic about what was happening. And in light of that, haklal b'mitzvah, when we think of religious things, shetov la'asok ba'atzom yubishlucho. It's not just about making sure something gets done. It's significant that you be the one personally to be involved. Masha'en kein yefes, but yefes shehirgeshu haya mitzad seichel enoshi. He also thought, what a terrible bizayon to our father. It's not his dignity. It's not right. But he thought of it the same way an ethical, secular person would have thought of it. You know, it was no religious, or I guess to be more precise, there was no spiritual impulse. It was a more general ethical impulse. Shelo ye'av mutal b'bizoyon. No, you don't have to be religious to think that a father shouldn't be left like this. Al kein, but, he says, in light of that, what's the difference? One difference, subtle but important. Ein shum seichel enoshi nosin la'asos pa'atzmo. If you're just thinking from that more general, if not... It's not secular, it's not the right word I'm looking for, but that more
universalistic
or ethical impulse, it's not so much important who covers him, but that he should be covered. What's the difference if I do it, or as long as someone else does it? And that's what happened. Yefes didn't care as long as it got done. So shame, Davka cared, he wanted to do it. So shame went first because he thought he could do it himself. I guess that's a typo. Excuse me. He needed extra help. He needed an extra hand. Yitzaref Yefes Kamkein. So again, is this really pshat in the pasuk or not? I leave that to you. You know, your own personal opinion. I'm not sure that I'm necessarily convinced or not. But the larger, but it's certainly a creative and original reading of the pasuk. And second of all, the larger issue, which I think is an interesting one, is this notion again. And I said the Netziv speaks about this concept really segues from back from what I had said to you in a minute ago. The Netziv is one of the people who often talks about the notion, and maybe not often, but he does talk about the notion in other places, of there being multiple impulses. The idea that there can be spiritual impulses and there can be something that we have at other times called kind of like an ethnic independence of halacha. And yet, here's the point which is so important, that even someone like Netziv who can conceive of that still maintains that there is still a difference. In other words, there is still a hierarchy and a higher level, and the spiritual impulse will be more ambitious even than the more minimalist but nevertheless ethical impulse. Okay, moving on. So, what happened after he was clothed? So we read in the next pasuk of Dalid, "Vayiketz Noach miyeno." He awoke. That's a weird phrase, no? What would you have expected it to say? Mishenaso. He awoke from his slumber, from his stupor. From, you know, I mean, I don't have to ask the kids in college what other words they use now. From his binge, from his buzz, from his hangover, from his whatever, Rachman al-Islam. He woke up from it. And he knew what his younger son had done to him. So one question is, as I just said, why me ye no? It's a weird choice of words. Right, but again, is that the best way to say it? Mishenaso.
That's sleep.
Good, okay, fair enough. And a second point which is striking is, depending on how literal you want to take the end of half, how would you translate the second half of the pasuk? And he knew what? So what's the focus? What's the focus? There's two factors there. What happened to him and who did it? So how... So if you want to be more just, you know, laissez-faire or more, you know, reframe the pasuk and summarize it, I would say he knew what happened to him. And again, depending on what happened to him, it's pretty easy to understand, especially if he was physically violated, you know. And even if he wasn't, he may have had some kind of a, you know, after, you know, they might have put this simla on him, but that wasn't what he went to sleep in.
But how how would he have known who did it?
Ah, that's my point. Exactly my point. But if, no, good, exactly. That's exactly what I was hoping someone would anticipate. But if you take the pasuk more literally, how would he have known who did it to him? So let's take a look. So in order to answer that, let's take a look at the Netziv. So again, I didn't see anyone else who was sensitive to this, but the Netziv, again, says something very sharp. Miyeno, lo rak mishenoso, hekits elagam miyeno. Not just from his slumber, from his sleep, but he got up from his wine. Now what does that mean? V'hoya daito shafoi legamre. In other words, you can wake up, but still have a hangover. I never had it, but I'm told. You know, you can wake up with a headache, you can wake up groggy, you can wake up not exactly clear. That would have been, he kits mishena, so he finally woke up, but you know, he might have still been in 80% for a day or two. But no, the pasuk attests miye no, by when he woke up, however long it took, he was fully and completely sobered up. He had no lasting effects. What's the point? We're grading him, you know, on how good, how well he reacts from being drunk. No, says Netziv. There's a very important point. Al Kain, because he was completely of right mind, sound mind and spirit, Al Kain chala alav ruach hakodesh. He had a transcendent spiritual moment which he would not have had he had some remnant of alcohol. You know, from the spiritual perspective, it's the exact opposite of the artistic Woodstock mindset. Of, you know, needing external things to give you spiritual or emotional high experiences. From a religious perspective, it's just the opposite. If you had any of those external stimuli in you, he would not have been able to have the Ruach HaKodesh. But because he was fully recovered and fully himself, he had Ruach HaKodesh. Kesher Haya Mokshar, when he was then ready. Al Kain says that it's Siv, and that's the flow of the Pasuk. Vayeda. Once he was fully sobered up and had this spiritual experience, apparently in Ruach HaKodesh, naturally there would have been no way to know who did it, and it's not likely that Ham would have come forward, or Canaan, whoever it was. And the fact that it's unclear, it would have really been impossible to know. But no, apparently says in the Tziv, again, it's not the only pshat in the Pasuk, and Jean's pshat is certainly would be a reasonable one, that it's just another way of saying the same thing, maybe even more descriptive. But the Netziv is certainly, again, it gives us what to think about, and certainly a larger lesson there. Yes? What do you mean? We're on to the next point.
What point
he just mentioned. He mentioned that maybe me know is just in a way of saying he's sobered up. Yeah, that's what I meant. Okay. Before we see the next psukim, so now that he woke up and he sees what happens, so now he's ready to pronounce judgment on his children. Please. Yeah, I alluded to it. We didn't talk about it. It's a huge discussion in Mepharshim.
Using the wrong word for young son, because it would be Benohat Sa'ir, his young son.
Sa'ir, is that a Chumash word, Sa'ir?
I think it is. But I mean, I won't argue, but I think Katan here means in stature.
Well, we're going to get to that. We will get to that.
That's Rashi.
Yeah, Rashi says, where is it? Bina Katan, Hapostle, the defective one, the Habazwi. Yeah, that's all part of the discussion of who was really the youngest son. Right. Okay, good.
He was the youngest, right?
Okay. Good. So the next few psukim, are where he gives the curse to Canaan and then the rewards for Shem and Yepheth. So before we even see those, just worth noting, you don't always get to hear this about psukim, but take a look at what Rav Hirsch says about these psukim. Rav Hirsch says, that which is said in these verses contains perhaps the deepest and farthest reaching prophecy which ever a human eye has been allowed to see of the future, and which God has allowed to be spoken by human lips. The whole history of mankind, the beginning and the end and the middle, lies in these three verses. Which is another way of saying that in the next 20 minutes we will not really understand them. Because what we're going to understand in the next 20 minutes would be hard-pressed to justify that level of accolades. And one would work with the assumption, I think, that Rav Hirsch, even though he was a poetic or a flowery writer, But at least from his perspective, you know, I don't think he would be given to hyperbole. You know, you have to always know, you know, yeah, it all depends on, you know, sometimes you can take things with a grain of salt, but I don't think we should. That doesn't mean Rav Hirsch is right. That's a separate issue, but he certainly meant it. He didn't mean it in exaggerated form. You know, my parents called me up, I was meeting my parents after Shabbos, so they mentioned to me that they had such great nachas because a friend of mine who is a fellow Rav, same age as me, in another community, himself nice and successful Rav, was down in Florida and introduced himself to my parents somehow, and then was going on and on about how wonderful I am, which of course my parents were happy to hear. And apparently, you know, my father said, you know, we've heard compliments about you before, but I mean, he was talking like. So I said, listen, the truth is, I recently saw him, and we corresponded by email. We hadn't seen each other in a while, and I can tell you, since I remember him from our days in yeshiva, and even from the most recent email, not that he doesn't mean it, he means it to a basic extent, but trust me. He likes to exaggerate. That's not my false humility. I could give you other examples where certain people, for whatever reason, are given to chanifa, are given to excessive compliment or flattery. You know, it's less problematic if the basic kernel is true. In other words, if they believe it, they just exaggerate is one thing. If they didn't believe it at all, that's completely dishonest. But here I said, I think he believes it. He does like me. But he happens to be very rhetorically gifted. When he's complimenting. Anyway, so my point here is that I don't think we would say that about Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch was rhetorically gifted, but if he thinks that these are that important, so he must obviously see a lot in mind. The truth is that I ran out of time and space on the pages, but the truth is if you take a look in the Rav Hirsch Chumash on the Baruch Hashem Yafas, he has like 3 pages where he discusses, you know, the basic typologies and the, you know, the categories that shame represents in terms of spirituality and Yafas in terms of beauty and philosophy. And he certainly sees a lot that's deep there, although we won't have time to get into all of that. But let's take a look at the psukim, and we'll start off with the curse, and we'll end with the blessings. As the Torah does, we'll follow with the lead. Yomer Arur Kanan, so Hashem, so number one, Noach says, Kanan, the grandson, should be cursed. Eved Avadim Yelechav, he should be a servant, a slave, to his brothers. So why Kanan and not Cham? That we discussed last week. A big machlokes. Some say because he really did it. Others give explanations. Some of the sources which we didn't see last week, though I did put on your sheet. Take a look. Just to review and a little bit new. The Bereishis Rabbah there, Lamed Vav Zayin, quotes a machlokes. After all, the Medrash asks the question, which we asked. Harry, I think, asked last week, but here I have a Medrash asking it, Harry. Chom chata uknanis kalel. Itma, you know, as we would say in Hebrew, hayitachin, could it be? It's crazy. How could it be? So as a result, we saw the Mefarshim last week arguing about it. But what I discovered this week is that the Mefarshim are really debating two opinions in a Medrash. The Medrash quotes a debate between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemiah. Rabbi Yehuda says, the fact that the earlier part of the parak says Vayavarech Elokim es Noach ve'ez banav, the parak begins with Noach and his children being blessed, even though Cham was the guilty party, ein klala hava b'makam bracha. It was too late. He had already been blessed. Right. He already had superpowers, and there was no kryptonite. What are you supposed to do? He was already blessed. So Elamai, you had to find the weak point. The weak point was his son. You could go get him that way. Therefore, our Kanan, Rabbi Nechemiah says, no, Kanan Ra. It was Kanan who did it. It was his fault. He's the one who saw and told them. He was the one who caused the curse, and therefore he's the one who gets it. The Radak says something interesting, which I'm not sure I understand. But it seems interesting, and I also made a typo there, I just noticed. Vayomer Arur Kanan, so Hashem, Noach says Arur Kanan, Kilel Kanan, Al Yidei Nevuah, Kineskaima Bo Kiloso. So what I think he's trying to say is that Noach saw through Nevuah, we saw the Netziv mentioned Ruach HaKodesh, here we have Nevuah, he noticed through Nevuah that coming out of Kanan would be Rishayim, would be people. In other words, this is almost like the source for the notion of a self-fulfilling prophecy. As he saw what the future would be, and kind of the curse was a confirming reality. After all, he says, Ha'avos hayin is harami lehischatein biknan b'pnei shahaya b'kulol. So I'm not fully comfortable that I understand this Radak exactly. I feel like I'm missing something. But the kind of salient point that definitely comes out of it, despite whatever details I don't get fully straight, which I just thought was interesting and I haven't seen anyone else say, is that according to Radak, there was some kind of an interplay between what was, you know, almost destined anyway to happen to the descendants of Canaan and Noah's decision specifically to curse them. That it wasn't completely causal, that they only were bad because of the curse, but there was something of an interplay, dynamic interplay, between both of those phenomena. What does it mean to be Eved Avadim, this double language? So double languages in Tanakh can mean what? Sometimes they're just meant as influence. So take a look at the first few Mefarshim seem to say that. Rabbeinu Sadri Gaon says, Eved Avadim, Eved Reshubot. You know, some people get better gigs than others. You know, he was, in the real deep south. Real, you know, very, very enslaved. Ralbag, something similar also. Eved Avadim, Ratzalomar, Avdos Chazak, V'Niflo. A real, real difficult servitude. And he gives the example of the general phenomenon of double language. Koinyan b'kodesh kadoshim, right? When we sound like the Holy of Holies, what does that mean? Same thing. Sharotzen bo shubu madrega gavoha me'akadusha. It's a way of adding emphasis that it's really, 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 really holy. Take a look at the Sephorno. Sephorno dovetails with the Rashi that Alan brought to our attention a few moments ago. And says, Eved Avadim, Kiyoso Eved Le'echov. Meaning, Hayaroi lo v'teva. Kevin shayakotin b'mayla ubozui mikulam. So the Sforno seems to try to combine two things. He says, when it says Eved Le'echov, it also relates to why it's Eved Avadov. Namely, because he was a servant to his siblings, who were also servants, and why was that? After all, you know, even among thieves, so to speak, you know, there was a hierarchy. Why was that? Because somehow, you know, there's a slave mentality. And he was the descendants of Canaan. It wasn't descriptive of him having harsher conditions as much as it was description of his personality. And Radak says, half of that, and the Hamek Dover will pick up on the other half. What does Radak say? Higam Echav Haya Avadim. The other children of Chum were also Avadim, which makes sense if you assume that Chum was the perpetrator, so why just pick on one line of children of Canaan? He had other children. So says Radak, you're right. All of the children of Chum became cursed. Why was Canaan singled out? For who ye Eved Lahem? He will be a servant to them, Kol Shekein Liyefes. Now why? Here Radak doesn't say, but presumably it goes back to the fact that he seemed to have had some role in it, or perhaps according to Sforno, his personality made him more subservient. Again, Lahavdil, but I'll give you as an analogy in a certain sense. Sometimes, Rahman al-Itzlan, in the Parsha of abuse, and we could have this whether it be spousal abuse or with children, you find that there are certain people, it's certainly the case with particular women, and it can be with particular children, who get abused over and over again. With children, it can be more striking because sometimes you have people who are abused by different people in completely different contexts. And in fact, sometimes when you first hear about it, it's almost, you're tempted to not give it as much credence, because what are the odds that when he was home he was abused, when he was in school he was abused, when he was to another school, I mean, what did he have, a sign that said abuse me? And the answer, in fact, often the case is, exactly. There are certain personalities, sometimes the first abuse leads to the other ones, certain kind of nonverbal communication and messages that unfortunately certain people, obviously unbeknownst to them, give off, you know, I'm vulnerable. I won't fight back. I won't tell. I'm not saying this is always the case. That's not at all. But sometimes you see this. You see this where certain people are just prone, Nebuch, Rahman al-Islan, for multiple, they're very, very susceptible to multiple abuses because of, as kind of, to borrow the Sforno's phrase, because of their teva. There's something about them, whether it was a by nature or by nurture, which almost Kilu invites it. And you have this with certain women as well. Why is it that certain women, you know, are more quick to leave abusive relationships and others aren't? And more interestingly, you have some women who will have left in one abusive relationship, and coincidentally, the second husband's also abusive. Were they looking for it? Are they masochists? The answer is no, of course not. But certain people are attracted to certain types, and certain people attract certain type. So as a cruel analogy, but that's what I thought of when I saw this sforno. Even among slaves, you know, there's a certain human nature tendency. You see this, I think, anthropologically and historically throughout cultures and times. Even everyone wants to be on top of somebody else. So even the, you know, discriminated against minority figures out within their culture something that they can discriminate against. It's a way, you know, it's similarly here in the other direction. Even within the other slaves, Canaan had something about them that even within the degraded class of children of Ham, they would be even more degraded and even more persecuted, so to speak. And the Hamei Gavar, building on this more psychological theme, says something very, very profound. And again, I thought of it, especially in light of yesterday's events. And as I say, regardless of how excited or not you are about the new president, but certainly there was something historical, no matter what you felt. And I was reminded of that a little bit by this very, very fascinating nitziv. Again, you know, as the Chazal say about their own comments, sometimes Divrei Torah aniyev makom echad asher makom acher. You know, sometimes you can have parshios where there's nothing written on, then you have other parshios where there's an overabundance. So we haven't had a nitziv in I don't remember how many weeks, and tonight we have three. So this is how it goes sometimes. But I think all three were worthwhile. Says in the tziv here, Eved Avadim, why the double language? And he starts off by asking a more broad question. Are you going to tell me that every slave in human history is a descendant of Canaan or Cham? Give me a break. There were people from all of the various children of Noah that one way or another in their lifetimes, in their historical lifetimes, became slaves. And just the opposite. Lo, this is a very important statement by the Nitziv. Lo kol b'nei Canaan heim avadim. V'harikam umos gedolos yatzmimenu. You shouldn't think that this is so deterministic that every child who ever came from Canaan was going to be a slave. On the contrary, many of them might have been mighty and successful. So what does that mean to say that it was Canaan? Ela haklala haya asher mish yagia lazeh. Within the people of Canaan, not that everyone would become a slave, but those who did become slaves, zelios eved yemesugel lazeh. There was something in their nature which made them susceptible to that. Kasher hu mizera avadim, as if someone was born into it. Mizera avadim yileda mibetin mihirayon. Just like somebody who was born into it and it's the only thing they ever knew. So, not that it's impossible to break free from it, but it's going to be less likely. You take certain things for granted. You know, that's just the way it is. We just don't get to do this. We just have to do that. I never knew anything different. My mother knew everything different. So too says the Hamek Dover, just like that would happen literally if someone was born into it. So too he says the descendants of Canaan have it, at least some of them, in their DNA so that they are susceptible to it. Again, similar to that Sforno, they're susceptible to it just like someone who was born into it who would have been more vulnerable as well. Masha'en Cain, generally speaking, the descendants of Shem V'Yefes, ain't Zaro Mesugol Lizeh. They're not necessarily susceptible to that. They're not susceptible. They're not by nature wired to be subservient, I guess is the better way of putting it. And therefore, even though there can be cases where they became slaves, nevertheless, it's different. Gam Behyoso Eved, but even if somebody like that became an Eved, unlike this person who was wired for it, who would be more willing to accept their fate and their reality, someone who's a descendant of Cham and of Shem and Yefes, even if they became a slave, Rucho HaPenimis Shoeif Lios Chavshi. Their spirit was crying out for freedom. They would want to be free. Umemela Ein Noach LeHishtamish. They wouldn't have been an easy, they would have been a very turbulent, a turbulent life. And they would work in order to make themselves free. And now this is to me the final hammer blow, a beautiful coup de grace here of the Hamek Davar. In halachic terminology, no matter where they're from, they could be Chinese, Japanese, West Indies, African, Canadian, South American, a non-Jewish slave in halacha is called a what? An Eved Kanani. Why do we pick that phrase? What if they can't all be descendants of Canaan, can they? No, says the Nitziv. Ba'asher hu muvchar sheba avodim afal pi she'enu mizera Kanan. Because Canaan personifies not just being a slave, but the slave mentality is the quintessential slave. And therefore, all slaves are known by that personification, even if they themselves may not have been specifically from there. We only have 5 minutes left, so let's just see a few comments now on the actual brachos of shame
and Yefes. So first of all, the Pasuk tells us, Vayomer, Pasuk Chavav, Baruch Hashem Elokei Shein. Blessed is the God, says Noach, of the God of Shein. V'yeh Kenan Eved Lamo. And Kenan will be his servant. So first of all, there are discussions, which we don't have time to get into now, why there's a repetition of Kenan being a slave. But we'll leave that. One question is, what does this mean to be the God of Shein? Isn't he the God of all people? This comes up sometimes when people are very sensitive, you know, the politically correct crowd in America, you know, what does that mean to say it's a Christian country? What about the rest of us? So what does that mean to say the Christian? So what does that mean to say the God of Shein? Isn't he the God of everybody? So the Mefarshim note that, says Radak, Amar Zebet Derech Nevuah, Noach said that prophetically, the Zachar L'Shem HaMeyuchad, and it was noted there here also we Dalk have a switch, we use the Yud Kei Vav Kei name of God. Why? Dalk was shame. Ki rov is there a shame, ye'am miyuchad, opnim Hashem miyuchad. Because the Jewish people, Klal Yisrael, Avraham Avinu, descends from shame. And therefore, because they were a unique people, who have a unique relationship and serve God uniquely, opnim Hashem miyuchad, they serve the God uniquely, v'yikra Elokim lehem. Therefore, this name of God was used for them, just like it says, Kmo Shomer Elokei Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov. Again, it doesn't mean that he's only their God, but they had the most intense and the most unique relationship with them. Dovetailing, or should I say, or elaborating on that basic theme, Rav Hirsch, you know, hundreds of years later, Rav Hirsch makes a similar point, that he says, Elokei Shem is meant here in the same sense as everywhere in the Torah we find expressions of Elokei Avraham. And now he gives, if I'm reading him correctly, a little mussar to his fellow from Jews. This never means the supposedly particular God of Avram, as people like to think the Jewish conception of God is of one that is peculiar to them. As we would have said in our vernacular, particular to them. As don't be so chauvinistic, like we're the only ones who have a relationship with God. That's not what it means. Chas v'shalom. Rather, the designation is common. It doesn't mean to say it at all. It's a very common designation. It means something else. What are the two things it means? Similar to the Radak, that God is specially revealed in the history and guidance of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We believe we had a special relationship with him. And number two is because they recognized him and proclaimed him. We're the ones, which everyone agrees, who brought him to the world. We brought the monotheism to the world. So because of that, he's known, you know, just like, you know, someone who discovers something, it's known by, right? You find a comet, you find a hurricane, you get to name it. Doesn't mean he's going to be the only one who benefits or suffers from it. So too, we found God, we have such a relationship with him, he's mentioned as our God. But it doesn't mean that we have the monopoly on him, or that no one else could have a relationship with him. And finally, concluding the brachos, the very famous bracha, Pasuk Chav Zayin, Yaft Elokim LeYefes VeYishkon Bo Alei Shem. What does that mean? Yaft Elokim, may God extend, Yaft, extend to Yefes, VeYishkon Bo Alei Shem, and he will dwell in the tents of Shem, and again a third time, V'yeh Kenan Eved Lamo. Kenan will be the servant. So, first of all, again, this is where Rav Hirsch and others do spend a lot of time elaborating. I didn't have time to put it on, the sheet. But Yaft and Yefes, from the Lashon of Yofi, from beauty, the personification of Greece, and physical beauty, and science, and technology, which they embody. I just want to close with two Gemaras, two important Gemaras, which talk about this this combination of Yaft, of Yefes, and of shame, which is enigmatically, but clearly importantly, referred to in the Pasuk. So first of all, the Gemara in Yuma here, on the Daf Tesa Amud Beis and Daf Yud Amud Aleph, talking about the second Beis HaMikdash, says, at the bottom point, makes the point that even though the second Beis HaMikdash had much holiness to it, but the second Beis HaMikdash did not have the same level of God's presence. It did not have the same level of Shekhinah that the first Beis HaMikdash had. And it points out in the end here, Afal gab diyaft elukim liyepes, ein ha-Shekhinah shora ela ba'ohalei shem. In other words, since it was Yefes, it was the Syrian Greeks, it was that time, right, that eventually got allowed to complete and finish building up Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash. So therefore, as a result, it wasn't fully autonomous. We didn't have autonomy then. Therefore, it didn't have the full benefits. As opposed to Olei Shem, the first Beis HaMikdash, where we were totally autonomous in the time of Shlomo, where it was better. So that's one way of looking at that it's really a contrast, so to speak. But the more famous explanation is the one that comes from the Gemara and Megillah, and with this we'll conclude. And this is in the reference, of course, to the very famous story of Ptolemy the Melech, right, of the leader who wanted the 70 Chachamim to translate the Torah into Greek. It happens to be there, there's the famous miracle, this is the Septuagint, and they all made certain changes that they were worried about because they thought maybe the Torah was misunderstood, and they all, through miraculous means, made the same changes, even though in the 70 different rooms. But the context here is that the Torah, the Gemara says there's a halacha, you're not allowed to translate the Torah. And hereby, which I mean, I don't mean an art scroll, I mean a Sefer Torah with a klaf. You can't write it with any other letters or any other language. And yet, says the Gemara here, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Af besfarim lo hitiru shichtavu el yavonis. You are allowed to write a Sefer Torah with the ancient Greek letters. Amar Rav Yehoshua, Amar Rav Yochanan, Halacha Rav Shimon Gamliel. We pass in that way. Amar Rav Yochanan, my time, a why? Amar Kra, our pasuk. Yaf delukim liyefes, v'yishkon v'o'alei shem, devarav shal yefes, yu v'o'alei shem. The words, the kalim, the language of yefes can be in the tense of shame, and therefore you could write the Torah in the Greek. Now they point out, even just halacha lamaisa, that ancient Greek has been corrupted. It's not entirely gone, but the modern Greek is not that. I don't know the difference, frankly, but apparently it's different. But this was a real halacha, which, you know, at least in certain times in history. The broader issue, which is usually makes its way at the Hanukkah Devarei Torah, is the very famous phrase of Yaf Yifuso Shel Yefes Yishkon Ba'ole Shem, which is often seen as a clarion call for a kind of synthesis between the notion that the Greek notions of beauty, etc., their problem wasn't that they had aesthetics or science, it was that they made it into an end in of itself. And if you can synthesize and harmonize the beauty of Yefes, which it really is beauty, we shouldn't deny it, but we have to harmonize it with all a shame in the context and with the parameters of the tense of shame, then that seems to be the longer bracha that is being given. Just to make reference to the final psukim here, the end of the perek tells us about the death of Noach. It ends on a whimper. Vayhi Noach achar hamabo shlosh meos shana v'chamishim shana. Vayhi kol yimei Noach tsha meos shana v'chamishim shana v'yamos. 950 years, and Noach died. So he lived after the flood 350 years. That makes him 650, 600 to the end of the flood. He lived another 350 years, and after 950 years, he died.
Abram was 58. Abram was 58 when he died.